and good evening, and welcome to Shattered Lives. Hello, everyone. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice. And we here at Shattered Lives are very excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victims' families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to the show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, if you don't happen to be able to listen from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern when the show is aired, please do look for our archival feature in about 24 hours after the show is aired, and look for our graphic. It's the big red heart with the cracks signifying our show. And so with that, I want to say good evening again and welcome to another Saturday evening. For any new listeners, I welcome you very much, as well as repeat customers. And what's nice is that I'm hearing that the show is growing and growing, which I love to hear. I think we're doing a public service, and I have to tell you that I love doing this show. The diversity of topics and the people that I've met, the different regions of the country, and just what we learn and the interaction is wonderful. And I have to say, there are two people that I owe that to, and had it not been for Susan Murphy Milano and Delilah Jones, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair doing this. So I say thank you. With regard to my co-host today, I won't do a big speech like she usually expects. Just suffice it to say that, you know, the longer that I know her, I realize that she's just a stellar, really good person on every level, both professionally and personally, opening her heart and her hearth and her home to our dear friend Susan, who I think you all know by now has stage 4 cancer, and we're all holding her hand through hell, but she is going through it like a trooper. And just to give you a little update, there is a new blog that Delilah did post today. It's called Let's Plant the Seed and Raise the Bucks, because with a disease like this, it's pervasive not only on your body and your mind and your soul, but your pocketbook. And so we're looking for any type of fundraising that you may be able to glean, both personally and through your own contacts. So please do go to conqueringcancer.me, okay? And we so appreciate that. With regard to myself, before I bring on my guests very shortly, I just want to ask, if you listen to this show tonight and you know of one other person who is your friend, who is your coworker, a colleague, who may be interested, please just pass on the show to one other person, because the more people that listen, the more people will be educated. And with regard to my future career aspirations, we all know that I'm wanting to be in a different location, perhaps in a warm weather climate. Right now I'm zeroing in on the Myrtle Beach area, perhaps, and I'm hoping to do maybe a future project with people there and human trafficking. So please, if you're listening from that area, please do have them get in contact with me or with Delilah, okay? Delilah, come on board. Thank you so much for joining me again.
Hi. I'm here every week, your little roving co-host.
Yes, you are, and it is a joy to have you. We so appreciate everything that you do and your perspective. And I have to say that we're getting out of Connecticut tonight, Delilah. Yeah, we're going to the heartland. We are going to the heartland, and I have to say I'm so pleased to have this gentleman on. We had the very distinct pleasure of meeting David Francis, who is the father of John Francis, who is the topic of this evening's discussion. And David is the president of an organization, and he's also written a book called Bringing John Home about the disappearance of his son as a result of mountain climbing. And so I want to say thank you so much, David. Please do join us, and it's a pleasure to have you.
Hi, Donna, Delilah. Thank you. Great to be here.
Oh, well, you're so welcome. You know, this topic is a unique topic because I don't think that a lot of people have it necessarily in their head that these types of, I don't know if you term them tragedy, an accident that was unforeseen. But there are so many people who are athletes these days and so many people who mountain climb. And then what comes to my mind is the big craze these days of rock climbing walls and all of that. But I think you identified through tragedy a niche in the search and rescue arena that really wasn't served very well. Is that correct?
That is correct. What we discovered in tragedy is what fell on our family when our 24-year-old son went missing. And losing a child, we discovered, is the deepest sorrow known to humanity. It seems strange of all the bad things that can happen to you, but burying a child is the deepest sorrow known to humankind. And so we suffered that in grief upon grief. We were abandoned by the public sector. Our son was abandoned by law enforcement on the mountain.
Mm-hmm. David, before we go right. too far, why don't we give our listeners a little background on
right.
you know, just
what happened.
What exactly happened with your son?
Right.
Our son John was 24 when he went missing. He's the youngest of four. We have three daughters, and John is our youngest. There were 16 years between our oldest daughter and John, and our friends never really believed us that John was planned, but he was. And we raised him in Minnesota. He became a standout athlete in track and cross country. Ran with a perennial state championship cross country team that was voted national champion. In 97, he was a gifted runner.
Mm-hmm.
Left Minnesota for a Lutheran college in South Dakota, Sioux Falls, Augustana, and called me when he was a senior at Augustana and said, "Hey, Dad, I've decided to become a Lutheran." We raised him in the Episcopal Church, but when you raise a child in Minnesota and send them to a Lutheran church, conversion happens. So I joke with him. I said, "Hey, John, you'll still be a Christian, won't you?" He said, "Yes, Dad, I will." He majored in religion. He, after college, he went to Ogden, Utah to serve as a director of youth ministry. And in between, he was spending his summers. He worked during college, during summer at a Lutheran Bible camp in Idaho, Luther Heights Bible camp. So John was had graduated from college, was working as a youth minister, and was spending his fourth summer in the Sawtooth Mountains of central Idaho. And over the years, John had fallen in love with the Western Mountains, wanted to stay out there. And he climbed mountains, not only to challenge himself, but it was a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
He found God on the summit.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering if that particular mountain was his greatest challenge that he had pursued up to that point.
No. The Grand Mogul is not the tallest mountain in the Sawtooths. Thompson Peak is. He had climbed Thompson Peak 10,750 feet. Don had summited Mount Bora. It's 13,300 feet. That's the tallest peak in Idaho. The Mogul is less than 10,000 feet, but it's a rugged climb, I discovered when I made my first trip to the summit. It's a difficult climb. John was a fit. He was very fit as a runner and a hiker and a climber, and he was intelligent and smart. But we discovered, all accidents are caused by a series of decisions, some of them bad.
So, do you think it was a series of circumstances that you're saying that maybe were not foreseen by your son, who was very experienced and intelligent, and it just happened to, be that way, and this is what happened as a result?
Absolutely, and it happens every day. Since we started the John Francis Foundation 5 years ago and worked with families, primarily we work with parents who've lost an adult child or a young adult in the wilderness. That's our focus as a foundation because that's our personal tragedy. John climbed. He looked for partners, but no one wanted to get up at 7 a.m. and climb the Grand Mogul on Saturday, July 15th, 2006. So he went by himself, which people often do. I have friends and relatives who go out into the wilderness by themselves. It's common. It shouldn't be, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a unique experience to be in the wilderness by yourself.
Right. Well, can you tell us from your perspective what might have been the series of decisions that you talk about that led to the chain of events? Maybe so. Number one was he couldn't find a partner to climb with him, so he went by himself. And then what else happened in the chain of events or his thought process?
Yeah, it's a common question as we work with victim families and people who read John's memoir, Bringing John Home, will ask me, well, what happened? And I repeat what I've learned, and that's accidents are caused by a series of decisions, and some of them are bad. I always start with he fell in love with the Western Mountain. That was the first thing that happened. He went out solo, although he soloed many times and did it successfully. And this is part of the reconstruction we did after a year-long search to recover his remains. We did a bit of a reconstruction. He chose the most direct, but what turned out to be the most difficult descent off the mountain, and got into some what's called technical territory. That's an area on the mountain where you really need ropes and harnesses, equipment to navigate through safely.
And he didn't have that equipment, is that right?
It was back at his camp.
I see.
He could climb with ropes and harnesses. He could rappel, but based on what he knew about the Grand Mogul, he could successfully climb up using just his body, his hands, and his feet.
Right,
incredibly
strong. So he took the most direct route down without any equipment, and then what do you, as you went through your reconstruction, what happened next? Or what forces came to be that, he didn't get down successfully?
Yeah, well, we'll never really know for sure, but based on being up on the mountain and having both mountaineers and law enforcement and a coroner eventually went up on the mountain,
mm-hmm.
he down the north face of the Grand Mogul, which is a gully. It's made up of scree, small pieces of granite like gravel. And generally, that's an easy descent. You sort of ski down the scree. Well, he came face to face with a huge boulder that blocked the further descent at about 8,200 feet. And so at that point, he knew he couldn't go down the gully anymore, so he had to make a decision, either go back to the summit and find another descent route, or either go left or right. He chose skiers left, as they described it, which put him into an area west of the gully in a very ledge with decaying granite in areas, boulders and rocks that will give way under your foot. And,
oh my goodness.
He slipped or tripped and fell 120 feet.
Wow. That's very tragic.
The fall was caused his immediate death.
No doubt. I mean, for someone who is that experienced and that fit, and you know, seemingly had done this many times, it just is all the more so, must be so frustrating as a parent, because it's not like he was some amateur person. And that's one of the questions that I had here that I prepared in my list of prepared questions with regard to who presents a greater problem, do you think, when you're doing your education? Is it professional athletes who want to have an increasingly greater challenge, or amateur athletes who don't know what they're doing? I mean, in terms of adding to the problem or increasing the death toll with this type of endeavor?
Yeah, well, it's a segment of the population, young men in their 20s, who feel that they're invulnerable.
Or invincible, that kind of thing, nothing bad will happen to me.
Yeah, too much testosterone.
Uh-huh, okay. That totally makes sense. Wow.
One of our mission areas is to teach wilderness safety. I taught a class last year of 40 men and women who are in a hiking association in Minnesota, the Minnesota Wranglers. And before I began my presentation, I asked how many people go out solo, and half of them, about 20 people, raised their hand. It's very common, too common, that people will go out in the wilderness alone, because it's such a unique and spiritual experience. And at the end of my hour presentation, when I went through case studies of people who went in the wilderness alone and got into trouble, I asked the same question, and about the same people raised their hand. So I said either it wasn't a very effective presentation, or the pull to go out alone is just too strong, and they said in unison, we love going out alone.
For the spiritual experience?
Yes.
So that trumps safety. Is that what you're saying, David?
It often does. It often does.
Well, David, and with your trainings, knowing what you do firsthand of the dangers of solo climbing or hiking or whatever, there's some sort of programs or some sort of safety measures that you've put into place to teach people. If you're going to do this, at least do this much so that we know you're safe, people know where you are. I mean, I don't know how long. Here's another question. I'll just throw it out there to you while I'm doing it. How long before you realized John was missing? Did he have a cell phone? Did roommates not hear from him, or how did that come about that we knew he was missing?
We didn't get the call until the next day. He climbed Grand Mogul July 15th, We received the call at 3:15 on July 16th. It was a Sunday. And it turned out, as we learned more about mountain climbing and search and rescue, it was a typical screw-up. He didn't return to camp Saturday night as scheduled. And he wasn't there Sunday morning for the staff meeting. He was assistant program manager of the camp that year. So the camp director didn't call the county sheriff until Sunday afternoon, which turned out to be 24 hours from the time that he had his fatal fall. So one of the things we teach in wilderness safety is leave an itinerary behind, and if your loved one doesn't show up when they say they're supposed to, make the call immediately. Don't assume they've made a side trip or done this or camped overnight, or make the call John's call, when he said he was going to be there, he was.
Well, is there a particular protocol that, I mean, prior to you developing your strategies and your training, is there a protocol that in general hikers would follow, or is there not?
Yeah, what we discovered, Donna, is there are lots of classes out there on wilderness survival. You may have taken one,
mm-hmm.
two. Everybody's teaching wilderness survival. We say if you go out safely, if you plan ahead safely and take the proper precautions, equipment, if you have the knowledge you need, you're not going to need your survival strategies or knowledge. So that's what we teach is planning, having the right equipment, having the right knowledge, staying within your safety zone. John got outside of his skill level when
mm-hmm.
he got into technical terrain. Should have turned back had he had the opportunity, we're not sure. But it's really proper planning, having knowledge. One of the other things we surmise is that John didn't know the North Face as well as he should have. So you've got to know your terrain you're in, and you've got to stay within safe limits.
Mm-hmm. Now,
because when you stretch yourself, you're taking risks, especially when you're alone.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Would it, given the factors that you present, would it have made an appreciable difference had he had one other person with him at any point in time along the way?
Well, yeah, we always preach safety in numbers. And
right.
when you're by yourself, you don't have anyone to help you or call for help.
Right.
But there's always a chance that two or three climbers or hikers could have the same accident at the same time. But when you lose a child to a tragedy, you live with some regret. If he'd had a partner, perhaps it would have made a difference. The partner might have said, no, this is too dicey. Let's turn back.
Have another perspective on it. Yeah. Well, those are the if-onlys. Yes.
Could have, should have. We do a lot of shoulding.
Right.
John, in the many stories we heard since his loss, had a party turn back once because they were getting into a difficult area. So that's one of the many stories we heard about him. He was intelligent and cautious. So one of the what ifs might have been a partner would have said, no, I don't like this falling rock under my feet. Let's get out of here.
Right.
And they called us for help sooner and known where John was, because that was part of the heartache.
Sure. I totally understand what you're saying. Can you tell us, in terms of the numbers, how many people in their 20s actually perish doing this type of activity or have accidents?
I wish I had that number. When I get on a rant, I'll often say, the government keeps track of bank robberies, but they don't keep track of children who die in the wilderness. The statistics
right.
are not there.
Okay.
The Elk Mountaineering Society does a good job of doing case studies. But what we've learned in attending missing persons conferences, 140,000, there are 140,000 unsolved missing persons cases today, and the number grows.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, tens of thousands of people go missing, and a percentage of those, we don't know the percentage, are people lost in the wilderness.
That's what I was going to say. In looking at the many photographs from places like Peace for the Missing and the Q Center, I mean, you don't necessarily know that this person was an athlete and that's how they met their fate. But do they get reported just like any others would? Is there a push for that to, take advantage of the services such as the Q Center? Or has that been your experience?
Yeah, well, that's sadly, Donna, that's where families are turning, because we've learned that only 10 states in the United States require law enforcement to report the disappearance of an adult.
Right.
Someone over 8. It is a it's an unserved class. It's a group of people who are don't have legal protection right now. Minnesota is the 10th state because we worked hard to pass legislation here.
That's one of your shining achievements. That's very good. We also have in Connecticut, which I'm glad to report. Can you tell us? I remember when you were doing your address for us that the standard, if I can call it that, the standard search and rescue teams maybe are not entirely equipped to necessarily deal with this type of situation, in the mountains. And have you made a push to have these specialized types of certain rescue teams formulated such that, every state would have somebody to turn to if they're, engaging in this kind of activity?
Yeah, we're not doing a lot now, but it's one of the, if we had $1 million, we would provide more funding to search and rescue units who are self-funded. They search and rescue units have to hold bake sales to raise money for training and for equipment. They don't. Donna, they're some of the most generous people who walk the earth. When we unfortunately started working with search and rescue people, I was just blown away that they didn't get paid, that they do everything they do on a volunteer basis.
Right. It's incredible.
Occasionally law enforcement will give them gas money or food money, but...
Right.
And that's a mission area that we feel really good about, and that's reimbursing search and rescue. When they go out on a family-funded search through the John Francis Foundation, we'll reimburse the search and rescue. They never get paid. We don't give them any salary or hourly wage, but we reimburse them for food, lodging,
mm-hmm.
and travel.
That's very good. Yeah.
Which is unusual, but it should not be unusual.
Yeah. It's a sad commentary about, where our priorities are these days. And, I wondered if you talk a little bit about the challenges that you did encounter at the local, state, and federal level in encountering this situation? And was this the impetus, in fact, partly for you to devise the foundation and or write your book?
Yes, yes, all of the above. Our life is divided in half, a life of fullness before July 15th, 2006, and a life of emptiness. And this is not what I planned on doing in my retirement, but it is what it is. What we discovered is Linda and I and my family, and I think a high percentage of the population believes that government and law enforcement is highly trained and funded and committed to finding missing people. We found out that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
The small group that went in search of John in the Sawtooth Mountains had just recently formed. The search for John was their first organized search. And that is a wilderness area the size of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
The Sawtooth National Recreation Area is a wilderness area the size of Connecticut. And in 2006, it was a grassroots effort, they finally had a search and rescue team. So the search for John Francis was the first time they'd ever worked together. But they did an incredible job. Unfortunately, the sheriff was not going to lose anybody on his watch. He concluded early, we discovered afterwards, that John was dead. And he was not going to risk any of the volunteers in a body recovery. So he pulled the plug on it after 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
The incident commander came to me and said, "David, give your son up to the mountain."
That's just so callous and uncaring. I mean, being the recipient of that comment, I just can't imagine.
I know this, and you know this, David, from attending searches or attending conferences and being involved in the missing persons with families, is that especially adult male men is like the lowest priority for law enforcement. And it's very difficult to go to law enforcement to report an adult male missing and have them really take it seriously.
Right.
Because so
especially if you're a minority.
Right.
It's
too easy to dismiss it as somebody that just, didn't like his family and just decided to take off.
Right.
Yeah, one of the many tragic things we discovered is that missing adults are generally considered a family problem.
Right.
Law enforcement is not really trained, organized, or funded to go and search. Missing children, as you know, thanks to the effort of people like John Walsh and Patty Wetterling, have federal protection now.
Mm-hmm.
Missing adults, not.
Isn't it amazing how everything is considered a family problem when you're saying that, domestic violence or intimate partner violence is also, has that stereotypical, or used to be until people like Susan, brought it out of the closet, it's a family problem. How can all of these things be family problems? It's so frustrating.
I'm not there yet. I still have a control problem when it comes to talking about law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
when you think about it, and sometimes I do, it's a culture problem. It's a society problem. We are not requiring law enforcement. We're not training them. We're not funding their effort to go in search of missing adults.
Right.
We're not funding a lot of the important services, and it seems like, you know, people would rather spend their money on season tickets for a pro football team than pay a little higher taxes and have their police officers and their law enforcement and teachers and so on and so forth. Public servants need to be paid more. They need to be trained more. We wouldn't have to deal with a lot of this, a lot of these tragedies, a lot of this, I don't care attitude. If we would get our own priorities straight, it's really sad. It's a very sad commentary on our country and our people.
Right.
And trying to be rational once in a while, I'm capable of rational thinking once in a while, and it doesn't impact a large percentage of people. You know, anyone who is in the families we work with, once their adult child goes missing and law enforcement betrays them, as they often say, then they realize what a
problem
we have in the United States. And
they
get involved, but that's what it takes. One of the most common questions I get in discussions, and you see editorials, sometimes even from law enforcement, is why should we risk our lives? Why should we spend taxpayer dollars to rescue these people who decide to go out and climb mountains or go out into the forest by themselves?
Mm-hmm.
And whenever
so what is your response to that?
My response is we've made the commitment as a society that we'll go to the aid of someone who has an auto accident.
Right.
Even if they're a drunk driver or a reckless driver, we've committed as a culture, as a society, as a nation, that we will go to the aid of people in auto accidents and do everything we can to save their lives and help them get whole again.
Yeah.
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us drive an automobile.
Yeah, it's about numbers then, it sounds like, David. Everybody drives a car.
Yeah.
Wow, I never thought about it in that way. It's so true. My goodness.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the fact is, too, that people don't get involved in something until it happens to them or until it happens to someone close to them. You basically have your blinders on. You have your head in the sand. You don't know about issues like this. You don't know about what the families go through. You just don't know. You can read news reports, but how much, if you're not affected by it, how much do you really take in?
It's true.
Absolutely.
You do.
Absolutely. And Linda and I, my wife Linda and I, will often say, how many years we lived and sort of ignored news reports of people missing in the wilderness and didn't pay much attention or take much mind to it until our own son went missing.
Right. Well, that is true. And I mean, part of it may be, given our society's priorities, be as skewed as they are, I think part of this is human nature. You're not going to pay attention to this until it affects you or someone close to you. But I'm just, hypothetically, how do you begin to turn this around? Is it all about getting the funding to train people? Or I know a part of it is attitude change, but given your foundation and when people read your book, what is it that you have as reasonable goals? How do we change this so there isn't more John Francis's, you know, the example of what happened with him, so that we can kind of at least change the approach or the priority?
Exactly, Donna. And that, When we formed the foundation in 2007 and brought on our first board of directors, we did the groping thing. What are we going to do? What can we do within limited means? What should we be working on?
Right.
Many foundations are created as a result of personal tragedy. And the John Francis Foundation is, you know, one of many that we are trying to bring some good from our loss. So
right.
we looked around at what happened to us, what our misfortune was, how it could have been prevented, and how things have could have gone better for us and for John. So the first thing that we worked on and we continue to work on is to be a lifeline for other families. Frequently, too often, law enforcement gives up the search without finding the missing person, particularly adults. You know, when you're not required by law to search for a missing adult, sometimes it doesn't even happen. Searches for missing adults are uncommon compared with searches for children for the number of reasons we talked. So we decided as a foundation we were going to be a lifeline to other families, and when law enforcement abandons the search, we'll engage with the family and give them an opportunity to pursue a privately funded search. We did it. We know how it's done. We can do it faithfully and sometimes successfully. We searched for John for a year and a week and brought in hundreds of professionals and volunteers and spent $100,000. So we have knowledge to pass on.
Mm-hmm. Is that the typical amount, David, in terms of, you know, I know it's very expensive, but that would be kind of the average of $100,000 in order to carry on a fairly detailed search?
No, our cost experience was about $1,000 a day to have a professional, you know, maybe a dozen professional search and rescue people and dogs and a search manager, but we searched for 70 days to find John. So
wow,
the dollars added up. But if you do a week or two of searching, you know, it could be 25, maybe 30,000. $1,000 a day, and then we had a lot of airfares and lodging because we were searching in Idaho and brought people in from other states.
Sure.
So helping families, what we call resolve unresolved loss. And then we were encouraged to do more prevention. And that's our wilderness safety education to try to prevent accidents.
Mm-hmm. You have a specialized kit, don't you? Some type of emergency kits, is that true?
Yes, as we were putting in our curriculum together, Linda had this inspiration to try to write the main points down on a trifold, and she ordered low-cost, low-tech safety devices, a loud whistle and a reflective mirror. If you're lost in the wilderness and there are aircraft looking for you, and the sun is out, you can shine a mirror. So it's a Mylar mirror, and it's very reflective.
Uh-huh.
And a whistle. As we grow and get more money, we'd like to provide compasses and maybe GPS, personal locator beacon. But for now, it's a whistle in a mirror. in a cart with safety tips.
I see. When you say a beacon, is that similar to what they use if someone is kind of lost out in the sea? Kind of a blinking light of some type?
It's similar. It's a radio signal, a personal
okay.
locator beacon, and they're becoming almost reasonably priced now.
Mm-hmm.
But it sends out it hits a satellite.
Yeah.
And sends out, and you can program it, if you don't report in for several hours, it'll send out a distress call. Skiers use those a lot. And the danger is they might be buried in an avalanche. This radio beacon goes out.
Mm-hmm. And using that, yeah. Can you talk a little bit? We have about 14 minutes or so left to the program, about your decision to write the book and what that has done above and beyond what you do with the foundation?
Yeah, they're interconnected. When I was in deep grief, I started writing, journaling, it's sometimes called. I wanted to capture John's life and stories. I was writing stories, some of mine, and I asked his friends and many heartbroken people if they would tell me a story or write a story in a letter, and they did. I heard a lot of them around the campfire when we were in Idaho searching for John, a lot of campfire stories about John. So I started writing them down. And then I had the courage to open up John's laptop that I gave him during college and started reading his papers. John majored in religion, so he thought a lot about theology and a lot of papers about God and faith. And so I was in tears and amazement. I was reading John's papers from college, so I started forming a collection, which eventually became a book.
Mm-hmm.
I was encouraged by search and rescue people who worked with us and still continue to work with us to document the search for John. It was massive. It's a national case study in search and rescue because it was so large. So.
So it's a model example of what was done incorrectly or what should have been done?
Yes, to both questions. Yeah.
Is that right?
It took us a long time to get smart.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go to the North Face. You know, in retrospect, we didn't go to the North Face as soon as we did. We should have gone there sooner than we did. We delayed searching in the very treacherous, difficult areas for several months. So we knew where John was not, and then the obvious conclusion finally hit us on the side of the head. He must have chosen the north face as a descent. So a lot of lessons learned,
mm-hmm.
a lot of things that went well, a lot of people to thank.
Well, I'm sure.
And I had the names of people in every chapter, and my editor called me and said, "David, you're slowing the reader down by mentioning names. They're gonna go right over them." I said, "I know, but I have so many people to thank." She said, "You're gonna slow the reader down.
Uh-huh.
You might even get bored and close the book. So put the names in the back." That's one of the many things that my editor contributed to the book.
Mm-hmm.
She also said, "You're wailing too much." I said, "That's why I'm writing." She said, "You're wailing too much. You're repetitive. Put yourself in the shoes of the reader." So I finally did, and that made a big difference. Bringing John home is one a regional and a national book award for inspirational memoir writing.
Is that right? Wow, that's excellent. How has it been received across the country? Or, you know, are you in, you know, the major outlet? You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes and Noble, that kind of thing.
Yes, it's not easy, you know, unless if you're not a well-known best-selling author. It's
that's for sure. That's why you need Delilah.
There are a lot of books out there, and
yep.
In a limited amount of space on bookshelves. But yeah, it's available through Barnes and Noble. It's available through Amazon in hard copy, and it's also an ebook. We converted it into an ebook.
Okay, good. Have you had outreach beyond the northwest part of the country? Have you been able to collaborate with similar types of organizations in other areas of the country and come together for similar focus?
On a limited basis, and you know, Donna, you bring up one of our major goals, and that's to collaborate with other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Or I often refer to it as the U.S. government prior to 9/11. People are not collaborating. Even in nonprofit foundations, there are egos. And there's not as much collaboration and coordination. There are many organizations trying to do the same thing.
Right, to help create a public awareness.
Yeah, what we've discovered in the 5 years since we were founded is we are unique. There's not another nonprofit in the U.S. that does what the John Francis Foundation does, and that's family support, search and rescue, prevention, the wilderness safety education, and also legislative advocacy. So
you are unique to those functions.
We are. You know, one organization trying to do all of that. Many
yes.
organizations are doing things separately, but we're pursuing mission areas that are emotionally close to us in our hearts and also much needed in the United States.
Can you tell us a little bit about your fundraising? I know we said off air that you have, what is it, about four major fundraisers per year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do, we're online. There's the John Francis Foundation Facebook. And we do direct mail. We do primarily foot races. John was a standout runner, All-American national champion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of his character and part of what we remember often about him. So we have races in his honor, which is our fundraisers, and then we have our annual, what we call the event, which is a dinner party informational meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Someone suggested that we do the black tie silent auction, and I almost threw up and said, no, we're not going to do that.
Well,
don't mean to insult other foundations that do that, but I said, no, I can't do that.
Well, I guess to each their own. You know, when you need money regardless of how you get it. But, you know, I guess that everyone has their tolerance level. A couple other just very final things in the last 5 or 6 minutes here. How special was it? I thought it was very unique that you mentioned in your talk that, you know, John did. Was there a book at the top of the mountain where people could enter in their notes and observations, and you were able to retain that back as maybe one of his last communications. Is that right?
It's the last letter or note that John ever wrote. Yeah, many, not all, but many mountain summits have a registry where
okay.
the climbers who reach the summit can write in it. And we discovered part of the heartache is I went to Idaho and joined up with a search and rescue group and the sheriffs. And 3 o'clock Monday afternoon, the first full day, I went up to the incident commander and said, "Has anyone been to the summit?" He said, "No." I said, "What if John made it to the summit? You don't know that." And mm-hmm. I leaned into his face and said, "Send somebody to the summit." And there were two eager climbers who wanted to get involved in the search. They were standing around a pickup truck. So they made the summit in 3 hours and radioed back that they had found a summit registry in a note from John that said mm-hmm. July 15, 2006, John Francis from Ogden, Utah, climbed Grand Mogul, great times bouldering, all glory to God for the climb and the sawtooth. So we finally knew that John had made the summit because he left.
Wow, that's very special. And to think that the registry is up there, and when you get there, you can read it, and it's like a historical account of everyone that has gotten there. It must be very interesting to read.
It was. But entries back to 1965 were in there.
Really? Wow, that's pretty cool. Can you tell us in our parting time here, what would you want our national audience to know? I think I'm hearing from you, speak from the heart about the lack of resources and caring about adult males, adult missing, which we all share. But what else would you want us to know about what you do or advice to our audience?
Yeah, it's... I always consider that the magic wand question. Dave, if you had a magic wand, what would you do?
And magic wand.
I would create federal and state legislation that funds police training for search and rescue, provides money for the search and rescue units, and requires law enforcement to provide an adequate search for missing adults. They continue to fall through the cracks of society's sidewalk. Missing adults lack legal protection.
Mm-hmm.
They're out of sight, out of mind. So that's what I would encourage listeners to take some action in their state and at the federal level to provide legal protection to missing adults. It's injustice. It's obscene.
It's so very important, yeah. Can people get technical advice on your website in terms of what the search and rescue people should be doing in their area, if you're looking to take on a challenge such as that? Do you have technical resources there?
Yes, and one of the most important places on the johnfrancis.org website is the family support, where we have
okay.
a checklist and we have advice for families who suffer the misfortune of losing a loved one in the wilderness, because it's a time where you're distraught. You're not, you've lost your ability to think rationally, and it's helpful to have a checklist, say, okay, this is what we need to be doing right now.
Very good. Well,
created,
you know,
yeah.
This has been such an important topic. I thank you so much, and I can just picture, you know, that note up there as his memorial, and the work you continue to do. I hope that you'll keep in touch with us, because we can help pass the word on as well, and we wish you well in all of your endeavors, and we'll keep beating the drum on this issue as well, David. And I hope that everyone will go and purchase your book, as well as go to your site and make a donation. So thank you very much. And parting, please do go to my website, donnagore.com, and Imagine Publicity, for all the written information that people do in terms of their authorships, the projects that we're sponsoring, please do get in touch with me. I know that I can help you with some future career endeavors. And again, please do tune in next Saturday for another episode. Delilah, thank you so much for everything that you do for me. And don't forget Susan Murphy Milano at conqueringcancer.me. And we will see you next week. Thank you. Good night.